rescheduled in the next few days. So, I mean, 490, Act Make a Supplemental Appropriation to last the court system. If anybody's waiting on that bill, it will not be heard this morning. Take up this morning committee substitute for House Bill 39, Act Relating to Services for Pregnant Women. Senator Bakes.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. House Bill 39 was introduced in the 12th legislature and passed the House and got the Senate rules and didn't get out of there. It's back with us again this year, and it did pass the House overwhelmingly. This bill provides for prenatal services, including costs of transportation to and from a foster home or maternity home, counseling, adoption assistance, maternity and foster home care, and parenting skills. The bill has three versions of fiscal notes. The department did revise in the House, in the Senate HES Committee, the fiscal note down to $720,000. The original bill did not cover the actual medical costs. The House HES version did include the actual medical costs. The Senate HES fiscal notes removed the actual medical costs from the cost of the bill. So we do have three fiscal notes. The Senate HES fiscal note is the one that the sponsor and I would support at this time, and I believe the department supports it also. I'd like the committee to hear from Representative Miller on talking about the specifics of the bill, and then I have two small technical amendments I'd like to bring forward to the committee after we hear from Representative Miller.
Mr. Chairman, members, thank you for hearing this legislation. Members who are on this Finance Committee from the 12th legislature will remember this bill, too, because it did pass out in essentially the same condition, except for the removal now of the medical aspects. You'll recall that in the last legislature, we did make Medicaid available for women in this situation, so the medical aspect is no longer needed in the legislation. Mr. Chairman and members, although the word is never mentioned in this bill, in a sense, this bill is somewhat about abortion in that it provides for low-income women an alternative, if they choose to avail themselves to it, of abortion. Certainly, there's nothing mandatory about this at all. The state, as you know, will fund virtually all the costs of an abortion for low-income women. This legislation would fund what you might call the other side of the coin. If the woman chooses not to choose abortion and instead wants to bring a baby to term, either to keep herself or to put up for adoption, this bill allows some state assistance to achieve that alternative. And for that reason, and I still continue to think rather amazingly, this bill is supported by both pro-life and pro-choice individuals. It's supported by people who are high in the hierarchy of various churches. It's supported by people who have absolutely no church affiliation, or for that matter, perhaps even belief. It's just an unbelievable wide amalgamation of support for this concept. What it says is that if a woman chooses not to abort a pregnancy, that instead she can come to a home, which incidentally the state will not run. It'll be on a subcontract basis, for instance, with the Booth Home in Anchorage, although other places are interested as well. There will only be one public employee created by this legislation. That public employee will phase out in a couple of years, and his or her duties will be accomplished by the various regional offices of the Department of Health and Social Services after the program is, you know, initiated and in the works. Unless you have questions, Mr. Chairman and members, I just want to emphasize again the inherent fairness of this type of legislation, where where right now a person can, if they want to, get an abortion, this gives them the alternative not to, with state assistance, just as they can get state assistance for the abortion. I'm aware of the technical amendments that Senator Fakes has before you. I support them both. One came as a result of the Health and Social Services Department. It adds the words "within appropriations," and I think that's a very good amendment, because otherwise you might, since the language is mandatory, if you didn't have that in there, it might be construed that the state has no alternative to provide this service, even if we, the legislature, don't appropriate for it. The amendment would make it abundantly clear that the monies for this purpose would be limited by the appropriation process. And again, I thank you for hearing this bill, Mr. Chairman.
Any questions? For a second.
Just one question. On the expenditures, they base the total cost of the expenditures of $710,000. This is for Senator Fakes. 720,000 total, based upon the number of births and the number of births for unmarried women as a percentage of that. Do you have a breakdown that would show of the unmarried women how it was broken down into, say, rural versus urban? And those numbers, because I think that would be another factor.
Yes,
because you wouldn't be using the service at all.
I have information. Do you have the information provided by Booth Memorial Home, the Salvation Army, listing where people came from?
Mm-hmm.
The folks, it's the last page of that Salvation Army, and
out
it lists
433, 271.
Percentage of rural Alaskans, it says 62.5%. At that one particular home.
That was at that place. What about the total that don't go to utilize any service of that sort?
I don't know if we have any way of knowing how many youngsters or how many women out there aren't going anywhere.
But they do know the number that are born to unmarried. And is the 700 based upon 100% utilization of the 1,800 people?
Okay, yes.
But that's an erroneous one.
Well, but they feel that this isn't even enough money to meet the need, that this is enough money to get the program started and to meet a percentage of the need. And maybe Mike Pugh of the Department of Health and Social Services can give you a more accurate picture of that.
Okay.
Any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Anyone else here to testify?
Yes, I'm John Pugh from the Department of Health and Social Services. And I could, I think that Senator Bakes and Representative Miller have given a fairly good background of what the bill is. I could speak to Senator Sackett's information or the question. I don't have before me the exact breakdown of rural versus urban. However, in the breakdown, in terms of the number of births to unmarried women, we are not estimating 100% utilization of the program. What we're estimating in this fiscal note is that, for example, of what we consider to be the population that might use the program would be the age groups from 13 to 24, that probably once individuals get above the age of 24, there would be a dropping off of the utilization of this type of program. And in that group, we have a little more than 1,300 individuals, and we're considering that only approximately 190 individuals, particularly in the first year, would use that program, which would wind up to be approximately 15% of the total group.
Okay, the 700,000 equals 120 people?
It represents 190 in various pieces of the program. For example, we feel like foster home, as far as out-of-home type of care, would be the largest piece, because many individuals will come into Anchorage to use foster home until such time as the delivery from another area of the state or into Fairbanks. And so we're estimating approximately 114 persons would utilize that care. As far as the maternity home care, which is the most expensive, we feel that can be limited to a very small number of individuals who need that type of care. And we're indicating only 21 individuals would use that type of care.
Okay, how long do you take care of them?
And we're indicating from the information that we have from Booth Memorial Home that they feel approximately 5 months, that it would not be the full 9 month period. It would be coming in at some point close to after the first trimester, the fourth month, that kind of thing.
Okay.
So.
Any further questions? Thank you. Senator?
For the discussion of the committee on the Senate Hess version of the bill. Senate Hess version of the bill, on line 19, after the word shall, put in within appropriations, so that the line would read, Department of Health and Social Services shall, within appropriation, pay the cost of prenatal services. And I'd like to move that amendment.
All in favor of the amendment? Amendment carries.
On line 20, after the word natal services, or after the word services, put in, which are not available from an existing state or federal program. I repeat, which are not available from an existing state or federal program. The line would then read, natal services which are not available from an existing state or federal program other than medical services for a pregnant woman experiencing social and economic difficulties. And I'd move that amendment.
All in favor of the amendment? Amendment carries. Any further amendments? Any further discussion? Do we have a motion?
Be easier to do a CS.
Yes, I would like to move the bill out with the Senate Finance Committee CS, incorporating those two amendments, Mr. Chairman, and I move those out with individual recommendations.
All in favor of the motion? Carries. And that individual recommendations.
Thanks, Senator.
We have bill assignments here. Committee substitute for House Bill 194, an act relating to education of exceptional children, Senator Fakes. Senate Bill 352, an act establishing Alaska Railroad Corporation to manage the operations of Alaska Railroad, Senator Fakes. Senate Bill 431, an act relating to the purchase of residential child care facilities, Senator Fisher. Senate Bill 481, an act relating to cemetery associations, Senator Bennett. Senate Bill 484, an act relating to social service funds, Senator Fisher. Senate Bill 529, an act making special appropriation Department of Health and Social Services for a social service fund, Senator Ferguson.
And then call to them to see if they're interested in the project. Because if they're talking, they want to do something, that's one way to start doing something. And talk to them about today.
Call the meeting to order. First item up this morning is Senate Bill 402, an act related to exemption from tax or tax credits against tax.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate Bill 402 would amend Title 43 of the Alaska Statutes. It's the chapter of the Internal Revenue. This particular chapter and parts of the Internal Revenue Code are adopted by reference into the Alaska State Statutes. These provisions, which modify exemptions from tax or credits from tax, are not automatically adopted every year. We have a one-year lag. The federal government will do something with the or change the law in the Internal Revenue Code, and the state of Alaska has built in a one-year lag on this to give the legislature and the administrative branch a chance to look at it before we adopt it into code. Well, what this does, the present law allows for the immediate adoption of deductions, but not credits. So this causes the consumer and the tax people in the Department of Revenue to keep two sets of records, one for the federal government, which has got all the changes into it, and one for the state, which allows for deductions, but not the credits. The repeal would have no significant impact on revenue on the state, but would significantly decrease the burden of record-keeping on the taxpayer. And I have two folks here to testify this morning, Senator Bennett. Leroy Funk, who is a CPA in Juneau, would like to testify for the bill, and the Department of Revenue, Maureen O'Brien, is here, who can give us technical insight to the bill.
If they come forward, state the name for the record.
Oh, and I see the commissioner's here, too, if we really need a big gun. Thank you for coming, Commissioner. Appreciate that.
My name is Maureen O'Brien. I'm Director of the Audit Division for the Department of Revenue.
I'm Leroy Funk, Certified Public Accountant in Juneau and a member of the Alaska Society of CPAs Legislation Committee.
I think Senator Fakes explained this fairly well. Alaska statutes adopt all changes to the Internal Revenue Code immediately, except for changes to tax credits or exemptions. The modifications to the credits and exemptions are not adopted for Alaska purposes until the second January 1st following the effective date for federal purposes. And sometimes this is 1 year, depending on when the effective date is, and occasionally it is a two-year delay. This provision was passed in 1975 at the time that Alaska had an individual income tax. And in 1975, the federal government was passing various tax credits and exemptions for individuals. And it's my understanding that the intention of this provision was to prevent the dilutive effect on Alaska taxes of these various tax credits and exemptions that the federal government was passing at that time. Now, I wasn't with the Department of Revenue at that time. However, I went back and I looked at the various tax credits that were passed for individual purposes for individuals for federal purposes and went through the Alaska statutes. And in fact, we did not adopt the credits and the exemptions for individual purposes. However, for corporate purposes, all of the tax credits and the modifications to those credits have been adopted by Alaska, which to me is an indication that the intent of that provision in the statute was to apply to individual income taxes. Since we no longer have individual income taxes, we don't believe that it's necessary to have that provision. There have been several changes in federal credits recently in the last 3 or 4 years, which have simultaneously affected deductions. And as Senator Fakes mentioned before, this causes an administrative problem for the department and for the taxpayers. We do adopt changes in deductions. And when a credit is changed and tied to an adjustment in a deduction, for example, in 1978, there was a targeted jobs credit, and it was allowed for corporations, but they had to reduce the wage deduction by the amount of the credit. Well, a literal reading of our statute would require us to not allow the taxpayers to deduct all of the wages, and yet we couldn't allow the targeted jobs credit until 2 years after it was passed for federal purposes. In the last couple of years, there have been some changes in the investment credit provisions and the lives of the assets, and this was tied in 1981. There was a change in the depreciation method, which lowered the lives of the assets. For investment credit purposes, under the old investment credit provisions for federal purposes, you'd get 100% investment credit on an asset that had a 7-year life. However, when the lives changed because they were allowed more liberal depreciation, they went down to 5 years, so the assets that were 7 years had 5-year lives. Under the old investment credit provisions, a 5-year life asset was only allowed investment credit on 2/3 of the cost of the asset. And so we had a problem with whether or not we were going to allow them 100% investment credit. And it was a fairly difficult situation for both the taxpayers and the department to make that determination. And then just 2 years ago, in 1982, there was a change in the investment credit provisions for federal purposes where the taxpayer had to reduce the basis of the asset by 50% of the investment credit taken. And we would have adopted the reduction in the basis of the asset provision. However, we didn't adopt the change in the investment credit provision. And again, that was a very difficult situation for both the taxpayers and the Department of Revenue. Those are the credits, the only changes in credits for federal purposes that applied to corporations. We did eventually adopt these changes, and as Senator Fake stated, there would be no significant revenue impact in repealing this provision, which requires a 1-year delay in adopting changes in credits and exemptions. Does anybody have any questions?
Mr. Bryan, what do you mean by no significant impact? Can you quantify that?
I don't see any revenue impact at all. I don't know what's going to happen in the future. I don't know, if the federal government is going to change the credits because we don't adopt those, or because we immediately adopt the changes. There could possibly be in the future some kind of revenue impact. But as far as what the credits so far that the federal government has modified or passed, which we eventually did adopt, looking at those credits, there will be no revenue impact to the state by our adopting them immediately rather than waiting a year or two.
Any further questions? Thank you very much.
I don't know that I can add anything to what the two ladies have said, except that the Alaska Society, as a group, has talked about this issue for some time and just hasn't gotten around to initiating any legislation until this year. I talked, I believe it was 2 years ago, to the then director of audit, Mr. Kessel, and we agreed at that time that this was an issue that the Alaska Society and the Department of Revenue should attempt to settle, because it does just create a bookkeeping problem for taxpayers. The new jobs credit that came out was only there for 2 years. We treated that one way for federal returns for 2 years, and then when that 2-year term expired, the state picked up 2 years, so we treated it on the state returns for 2 years. And the net effect to the state, I don't believe, was any loss of revenue. To answer partially the question raised to Ms. O'Brien, the credits have always, to my knowledge, any significant credit has been allowed after the 2-year period, so that the Alaska statutes allow it anyway. It's just that 2-year waiting period, basically 2 years, that we've had to deal with. And those credits that have an expiration date have caused the most problem. There was a credit several years ago of $35 per exemption on a return. And if I'm not mistaken, one of the first orders of business during that legislature of the state was to approve those credits immediately so that we could treat those the same on the federal return as we did on the state return.
Thank you. Are there any questions? Member of the committee? Thank you very much. Do you have discussion? Do you have a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I'll move the bill, Senate Bill 402, out with individual recommendations.
Motion before the committee to move 402 out individual recommendations. All in favor? Move. Next item up this morning is Senate Bill 228, an act relating to state aid for Indian tribes located on federal established Indian reservations. Senator Joseph.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. The purpose of Senate Bill 228 is to extend to the Metlakatla Indian community the benefits of two ongoing state revenue sharing programs. The Municipal Assistance Fund under Title 43, Chapter 20, and the Municipal Tax Resource Equalization Program under Title 28, Chapter 88. Under existing state law, the Metlakatla Indian community isn't eligible to participate in these programs because it is not a state law municipality. Senate Bill 228 applies only to the Metlakatla Indian community. Its passage would not affect the legal status or rights of any Indian Reorganization Act entity, traditional council or village, or regional corporation organized under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. Metlakatla is a federally recognized tribe located on the Annette Islands Reserve and is the only remaining federal Indian reserve now existing in Alaska. Metlakatla's government is organized under the Indian Reorganization Act of 1934. The Metlakatla Indian community provides the same kinds of governmental services as other local governments in Alaska. It provides police, fire protection, water, sewer, electric services, and garbage collection. The 12-man governing council passes civil and criminal ordinances which govern the conduct of people on the reserve, and it has established a judicial program and provides various social programs to benefit residents of Annette Islands. Senate Bill 228 would correct an inequity in the state law by extending the benefits of the state revenue sharing programs to the state residents residing on the Annette Islands Reserve. And as I recall, a question had come up in earlier committees as to why Metlakatla simply didn't incorporate as a municipality, and the answer was that this could jeopardize the federal reserve status, which the people of Metlakatla enjoy and enjoy uniquely. In the folders should be both versions of the bill, and by the way, there's the Community and Regional Affairs Committee substitute, which I think should be adopted for discussion purposes. A letter of intent from the Judiciary Committee, material by Steve Anderson, who is here, who is the attorney for Metlakatla, entitled Eligibility of the Metlakatla Indian Community for State Revenue Sharing and Municipal Aid Programs, minutes of the Judiciary Committee meeting of June 15, 1983, a zero fiscal note from the Department of Revenue, position paper with zero fiscal note from the Department of Community and Regional Affairs, correspondence from the City and Borough of Juneau, and correspondence from the Office of the Attorney General. With Steve Anderson is, I think, Mrs. Solomon Atkinson, who is a member of the council and I think former president of the council of Metlakatla. Steve?
Thank you, Senator Josephson. In light of your rather complete explanation and the work session that we had several weeks ago going over this bill, I think I'll keep my remarks brief and then try to answer any questions that anybody on the committee may have. As you mentioned, the purpose of the bill is to extend to Metlakatla the revenue-sharing benefits that are presently extended to state law municipalities in the state of Alaska. The Metlakatla Indian community is a federally organized Indian tribe under Alaska law, which basically means that it is a federally chartered municipal corporation, I think is the best way to put it. In other words, the Metlakatla Indian community performs all of the kinds of governmental services that state law municipalities do. But because it is chartered under federal law rather than state law, it is not under present state law technically eligible for revenue sharing that is extended to other similar communities where their governments perform the same kinds of functions. It's important to recognize that this bill, Senate Bill 228, is designed to deal only with the Metlakatla Indian community. And as Senator Josephson mentioned, it does not affect the status of any other Indian Reorganization Act entities or any organization set up under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. The Metlakatla Indian community is unique in Alaska. It is the only Indian reserve left in Alaska after the passage of ANCSA, which specifically abolished all other Indian reserves with the exception of Metlakatla. I think it's also true to say that the Metlakatla Indian community is the only major native community in Alaska that is not presently receiving state aid. Metlakatla is a community of some 1,300 people. It has an annual budget in the neighborhood of $1.7 million. It's basically a community of the same size as other communities like Haines, for example, and has the same pressing need for municipal revenues. I would also like to emphasize that by extending revenue sharing to the Metlakatla Indian community, no special advantage will be created for the community, either under state or federal law. All of the other substantially sized Native communities in Alaska are incorporated under state law, so they do presently receive state revenue sharing, whereas Metlakatla does not. On the federal side of things, it's important to recall that under the existing federal statutes, the various IRA organizations in Alaska do receive federal aid. The word tribe in various federal statutes, which defines the eligible recipients of state aid under various federal programs, has been broadly written to include all of the other IRAs in Alaska, and in many cases also the village and regional corporations. So, for example, the Indian Self-Determination Act, which is probably the largest source of federal funding for Indian tribes in Alaska and in the rest of the United States, that program is extended to the other IRA councils and the traditional councils in Alaska. So Metlakatla, although it is the only native group in Alaska with the reservation status, doesn't enjoy under federal law any special benefits vis-a-vis other native groups. All of the members of the Metlakatla Indian community, of course, are citizens of the state of Alaska. And if the state of Alaska were to decide, for example, that it wanted to distribute, let's say, oil revenues on a per capita basis to individual members, individual citizens of the state of Alaska, all of the members of the community would be eligible to receive those payments. But under existing law, because the state is electing to funnel its monies through municipal corporations, and because of the definitional problems that we've alluded to, the members of the Metlakatla Indian community do not enjoy these same benefits that are indirectly extended to other state citizens. And the purpose of Senate Bill 228 is to correct this inequity and to treat citizens of Metlakatla the same as other citizens of the state by extending through their government the same kind of benefits that other state citizens enjoy. Thank you very much. I'll be happy to answer any questions, if I can, that anybody may have.
In other words, as I understand it, Metlakatla took the option of not getting the benefits of the Native Claims Settlement Act.
That is correct.
And it importuned Congress to treat them separately at that time.
That is correct.
But at that time, the federal programs available to Metlakatla were much more significant than they are now.
Yes. Unfortunately, President Reagan has cut back very substantially on the federal programs that are available to all Indian tribes in the country. The cutbacks have been in the neighborhood of 45%. Which has been a disaster for Indian tribes all over the United States, including the Metlakatla Indian community.
Mr. Anderson, let me say one thing. There was some concern expressed that the adoption of Senate Bill 228 would be a precedent affecting other communities. Could you address that concern?
Well, Senate Bill 228 does not address the problem of the status or the eligibility of any other Native groups in Alaska for aid. It has been based on the premise that the Metlakatla Indian community, because of its reservation status, does have a unique role to play in Alaska. I don't want there to be any misunderstanding on this point. The Metlakatla Indian community does not oppose efforts of other Native communities in Alaska to enjoy state benefits. But I think it is clear that the extension of state benefits to other Native groups who are not on reservations is a different situation, and different problems are presented. For example, many IRA organizations are located in communities that are already organized under state law, and the citizens of those communities already get state revenue sharing. So a blanket extension of this kind of aid to all IRA groups in Alaska would in some cases result in double payments, and I don't think anybody intends that to happen. I think that the question of whether state aid ought to be extended to other Native groups in Alaska is a separate question that should be separately addressed by the legislature.
Well, how would, in addressing that, though, how would we distinguish the cases? In other words,
you have said that Medicut is unique, but if we were to answer someone who came in to this table and wanted similar treatment in an unincorporated village situation, what would be some of the answers we might discuss?
Well, if you were dealing with a community that is not organized under state law, I think by definition you're talking about a very small community. I don't believe there are any substantially sized communities in the state of Alaska that are not, with the exception of Metlakatla, that are not organized under state law. Metlakatla is a community of 1,300 people. It's a very substantial community, and so there are huge differences in scale between the kinds of governmental responsibility that Metlakatla has as opposed to other groups. Metlakatla, in my opinion, as Metlakatla's lawyer, does not have the option of incorporating under state law without jeopardizing its reservation status. There are definite legal problems that would exist because of the fact that all of the land is in trust on the reserve. It's the title to the land is held in trust by the United States government for the benefit of the community, and that's going to present jurisdictional problems for any municipal corporation that was attempted to be organized there. I think that the same problems do not extend to the other IRA organizations in Alaska who are not located on reserves and who don't have the same trust land problem that Metlakatla does.
Any other questions, Senator Fisher?
Mr. Chairman, one of the questions I have is pertains to the extent to which the population of Metlakatla is consists of members of the tribe as against non-members, and what is the status of non-members? If the money goes to the tribe, do the non-members participate in the affairs of the tribe, elect the governing body, and have a say in the disbursement of the funds?
Well, not exactly. There's a very small minority of people on the reserve who are not members of the community. Councilman Atkinson knows the exact figure. I would estimate that it's less than 10%. So it is a community that is very substantially composed of members of the community who are eligible to vote in community affairs. The revenues that would be realized by the community would, of course, have to be used for public purposes. And all of the Metlakatla community programs, of course, benefit both members and non-members. The community police department will take action to protect a non-member. The fire department will put out a fire to protect the property of a non-member. Many of the non-members, of course, are married to members of the community, so they're part of the familial organization. Persons, however, who are not members of the community are not allowed to vote in community affairs. But that's a situation that exists with every Indian tribe. Only the members of the tribe are eligible to vote in community affairs. And that's, of course, the vehicle that allows the tribal government to perpetuate itself as a native ethnic organization.
Chair, I note from the Judiciary Committee minutes that Metlakatla has not abolished the use of fish traps under the Alaska Constitution. Fish traps were to be abolished. To what extent is Metlakatla exempt from application of state laws?
That's a difficult question. The question of the existence of the fish traps was litigated, as I'm sure you know, Senator Fisher, and went all the way to the United States Supreme Court. Alaska is a public law 83-280 state, which means that state laws governing private civil disputes are extended to the Metlakatla Indian community. In certain instances, however, the community can preempt the application of state law by applying the community's law. But state criminal laws, for example, do apply on Metlakatla. I think, although as a matter of policy, ordinarily the Ketchikan district attorney will defer to prosecution in the local courts, at least for misdemeanors. Felonies are tried in the Alaska state courts. Basically, as to misdemeanors, there's concurrent jurisdiction. Both the community and the state have jurisdiction there. I think that Councilman Atkinson would also like to say a few words.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. I believe that Mr. Anderson has covered the bill and the needs very well for the Metlakatla Indian community. And we do have needs, and the reason why our people will not give up the reservation status is because they have a strong tie to the land. We have many pioneers, many elderly who have ties to the land, And to give up the reservation status would mean that they would have to give up their island. So although some of the youngsters now think that we should give up the land, give up the island, it's a small island. We have to listen to our senior citizens. And in doing so, there are many needs that we now have in Metlakatla. We have many programs, water and sewer, the garbage, utilities, health, fire. All of these we need assistance on. And as Mr. Anderson has stated, we receive $25,000 per year. We put that into our fire department. And no one is refused service on the island. We do have approximately 200 non-members living on the island. And with the assistance from the state in building our new complex, recreational complex, everybody shares in common. Everybody shares in common for the benefits of the fire department, the ambulance crew. So nobody is discriminated against. Thank you very much.
Mr. Atkinson, is your local school supported by the state or through federal funds or local funds or what?
It's through the state. It's
through
state.
The state.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
State operated school.
Mr. Chairman, I'm looking at the judiciary letter of intent and the CNRA bill, and in the last paragraph of the judiciary letter of intent, the statement is made that concern was expressed that the phrase local government, referring both to state law municipalities and to the Metlakatla Indian community, was unnecessarily broad. The committee discussed this matter with legislative council and recommends the language be eliminated and that the phrase municipality and federal Indian reserve tribe be used to refer to the legal entities for revenue sharing under the two state programs. The existing definition section clarifying that the Federal Indian Reserve Tribe refers only to Metlakatla should be retained. Mr. Anderson, do you have a sense of that? I gather that the CNRA did not do that, and I'm just wondering.
Well, as the bill was originally drafted, it used the phrase local government to refer both to the Metlakatla Indian community and to state law municipalities. And there was concern that that phrase was unnecessarily broad, even though the definition section clarified that it was intended to apply only to state law municipalities and a federally organized Indian tribe on the only reserve in Alaska, namely Metlakatla. And so the purpose of this phrase, it doesn't change the legal effect of the bill. It's simply a clarification so that the phrase municipality and federal Indian reserve tribe will appear throughout the Title 29 and Title 43 amendment to make it clear to the reader.
Okay. It's by definition, local government means a municipality or an Indian tribe located on a federally established Indian reserve. So it only applies to municipalities and Metlakatla.
That's correct.
Okay.
There was concern, obviously, about referring to directly to Metlakatla by name because of the prohibition on special legislation, and this is a way of dealing with that.
Senator Fisher.
Mr. Chairman, has the this is a question to Senator Josephson, if I may. Has the Department of Law been heard on this issue? We have in the file a letter of April 21 when the bill was apparently in its early stages. Has it been a position paper, however?
I think so. Yes, there's a letter of May 16, 1983, is also in the file. And it's addressed to Senator Gilman. And I believe, I haven't checked today, but I believe that the recommendations made there are adopted. At least I noticed that in the penultimate paragraph, you should consider including provision of legislative intent that neither the Act nor any action taken under it shall be interpreted to either expand or diminish the authority or jurisdiction of any Native Village Council. That has been done. And you'll also note that in the second paragraph, we see no legal problem with including Metlakatla as a recipient of the various programs established to benefit local governments. Notice in the second paragraph, the Attorney General says, in order to simplify the statute and avoid confusing the reader, we suggest referring to Metlakatla specifically, which is done in the intent statement, as well as identifying it as the only federally established Indian reserve in Alaska. I don't know if that has been done, but the definition
Senator Josephson?
Yes.
My recollection is that that was discussed at the Senate Judiciary Committee hearing, and Tamara Cook of the Legislative Affairs Council spoke, and she was very concerned about the special legislation prohibition. And I think the consensus that was reached there was that the substitution that was suggested by Judiciary would clarify that only Metlakatla was being referred to and would at the same time avoid any possible challenge to the bill based on the special legislation prohibition.
General appears to have suggested repealing AS 2989050 and supplanting it with a provision for aid to unincorporated communities generally. This is not done in this bill, correct?
Excuse me, Mr. Chairman, repealing what?
Well, in the third paragraph, the Attorney General says, we note that AS 2989050, state aid to native village governments, is amended in the bill to clarify that Metlakatla may not qualify both as a local government and as a native village government. That's the small amount, I think, that's paid annually to native villages. We have advised in the past that AS 2959050 could be challenged on equal protection grounds by an unincorporated community which is not a native village, which is a problem under existing statutes. We suggest repealing AS 2989050 and supplanting it with a provision for aid to unincorporated communities generally. This is not done. It's a separate issue. So to that extent, we've not acted on the Attorney General's recommendation. We're not making the thing worse by the passage of this, but he's noting an existing possible legal problem.
Any further questions?
Thank you very much.
Is there anyone else here to testify on the bill?
My name is Irvin Jones. I'm the Director of Administrative Services for the Department of Revenue and its division, among other. $60,000 that would go to Metlakatla would come pro rata from all other communities that are now participating in the program. And it would depend on the size of population as to how much effect that would be. The one thing that did concern me a little is that the version of the bill that I've been working with, and I think it's the latest, has an effective date still of an older effective date. And I was curious as to what the effective date would be. It would be important to us that it would be something in the July 1, 84, since we've already made a distribution on February 1st of the FY84 appropriation. So it would work a lot more smoothly if that were to take effect the following year. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Questions?
Thank you.
I agree with Irving, and I would move at this time that we change the effective date to July 1, 1984.
Motion before the committee to change the effective date, 1 July 1984. All in favor? Motion carries. Any further discussion?
Move the bill with individual recommendations. The
motion for the committee to move it out and individual recommendations. All in favor? Move it out and individual recommendations.
Yeah. The other bill, you mean?
Festival.
I signed it.